Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Q&A. I'm Jay Nordlinger, and this podcast is brought to you by The Spectator Magazine and ExpressVPN. I'll have more to say about these interesting sponsors later in the show. Speaking of interesting, our guest today is Greg Mankiw, N. Gregory Mankiw, The Economist. He is a professor at Harvard. He's the author of, among other books, Principles of Economics, which has sold over 2 million copies and has been translated into 20 languages. From 2003 to 2005, Professor Mankiw was chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. And I'm going to spell his name, M-A-N-K-I-W. Well, Greg, have you been spelling your name your whole life?
Yes, it's an unusual name, and people often pronounce it wrong. It's originally a transliteration from the Ukrainian. So who knows what a better spelling might have been in English.
Sure. How does the name sound in the original tongue?
I think it might have been closer to Mankiw.
Uh-huh.
So maybe a little bit like Kiev, perhaps, but sure. I'm not really sure. I've only been to Ukraine once, and by that time my family was sufficiently dispersed that I didn't have any original Mankiws to speak to.
And were your grandparents immigrants or further back?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes, all my grandparents. Also, all four of my grandparents were Ukrainian immigrants, came before World War I as teenagers. They arrived in the United States not knowing they'd stay here. But the combination of the war and then the Russian Revolution made returning home not very attractive. So they settled in New Jersey, where they met each other. The four grandparents arrived independently, but they met each other mainly through church social events. They got married. My parents were born here in New Jersey, and they met through church social events and eventually raised me in New Jersey.
Well, what town did you grow up in, Greg?
Well, I was born in Trenton, which is where my maternal grandparents settled. But about when I was about 9 months old, my parents moved to Cranford, New Jersey, which is a suburb, sort of northern New Jersey near Westfield. And I grew up in Cranford.
Now, not to embarrass you, Greg, but did you go to normal schools or special schools when you were a kid? I don't mean to embarrass you, but...
That's an interesting question. I started off by going to public schools, and in around the second or third grade, the teacher called my mother into the classroom to talk to her after school, and said, you know, we gave some kind of standardized aptitude test to the students, and Greg did very well, and we were very surprised. Because while I was sort of talkative and inquisitive at home, I was very shy and kind of lackluster in school, so they didn't expect me to do well. It was at that point that my parents decided that maybe the public schools weren't working for me, that I was sort of falling between the cracks too much. And so they decided to send me to an independent school. And I then, starting in fourth grade, I went to the Pingry School, which is an independent school in New Jersey.
And you went to college locally at Princeton?
I did. I went to Princeton. I spent 4 years at Princeton. I had a great time. It's a wonderful university. I then left Princeton to go do some graduate work. And I actually started both a PhD in economics at MIT and a law degree. I didn't finish the law degree. I did a year and a half of law school, but decided law wasn't really for me. But I finished the PhD at MIT. I then left MIT and joined the Harvard faculty, and I've been on at the Harvard faculty ever since, other than 2 years when I worked in Washington for George W. Bush. I've been teaching at Harvard every year.
Greg, does being an economist, certainly your kind of economist, mean that you know a boatload of math? Are you a math whiz?
Well, I started off as a math major in college, actually. When I started Princeton, I really had no idea what economics was. I wasn't really thinking about it as a career. And so I thought of myself as a math science guy. And so I started taking a lot of math courses and took quite a few math courses, probably not quite enough to be a math major, but almost. After a while, the math became more and more abstract and, as a result, less interesting to me. I was more interested in sort of applied problems. And economics became an area where you could use analytic tools, like mathematics and statistics, to address more practical problems. And that's really what attracted me about economics in the end.
Well, economics has been tagged the dismal science, but I forget by whom. But I've heard people like George Stigler say, nonsense. It's a marvelous science, a marvelous field, nothing dismal about it. What do you say to this?
Well, I think it gets a bad rap as a dismal science, in part because we're often reminding people of trade-offs, reminding people that every policy could have a downside, that if maybe you get more of this, you'll get less of that. And proponents of various policy proposals often want to treat them as if they're free lunches, as if everything good is going to follow from their proposal, nothing bad will follow. And where economists are usually in the position of saying, well, it's more complicated than that. And if you get more of this, maybe you'll get less of that. And you got to figure out what the right trade-off is. So I can understand why policymakers may view us as dismal at times, but I don't actually think of us as a dismal group. I think of us as people are trying to make the world a better place through hard-headed analytic reasoning.
Go back to MIT with me, if you will. Was the famous Paul Samuelson there?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was there. I took a course from him. Towards the end of his career at that point. The younger crowd was actually probably more influential to me. So the other person who you might have heard of who was there was Stanley Fisher, who was vice chair of the Fed until recently. He was my PhD dissertation advisor. Larry Summers was assistant professor at MIT at the time. And he was, even at the time, as a very young man, he was extremely charismatic. And you could tell that he was a shining star of economics. And he was very, very influential as well.
I think that Harvard was founded in 1636.
That sounds right.
And I believe it's true that Summers was the youngest person ever to be granted tenure at the college. I think he's been surpassed by someone since, but I think he was the youngest.
That could be. He was 28 when he got tenure at Harvard. He taught at MIT for 2 years, and then he went back to Harvard with tenure. He'd gotten his PhD at Harvard and then went to MIT for just a few years and went back to Harvard with tenure.
And you were 29 with tenure.
I was 29. In fact, it was my 29th birthday. They voted me tenure on my birthday.
No kidding. that's quite a happy birthday. At Princeton and MIT, among your econ profs, was there a mixture of approaches or philosophies? Did you have free marketeers, Keynesians, Marxists, Bill Buckley, my old friend and boss, used to joke that he majored in Keynesianism at Yale. he said that with a certain, in an acerbic tone. How about you?
Well, I think Harvard is actually a more diverse faculty than MIT. I think MIT is a fantastic faculty. I had a great education there. But there's sort of an MIT view of the world that was sort of founded by Paul Samuelson and Bob Solow, his protege. Sure. And I think it sort of continues to this day. And I think of them as basically center-left, if you put them politically. Mm. They weren't Marxists there, but there weren't Milton Friedman libertarians there. On the other hand, you had a lot of respect for Milton Friedman. Stan Fisher had been at Chicago for a few years before he rejoined the MIT faculty. And Milton Friedman's thought was very well represented through the lectures of Stan Fisher, even though Stan didn't always agree with Friedman. Mm.
I have to tell you, Professor, I've never especially liked the word capitalism. It's always sounded to me a little bit dirty. And I remember I brought this up once with Hernando de Soto. And he said, and I said, the word capitalism is in such bad odor, and it's used so pejoratively. And I thought he would defend the word. But you know what he said? He said, never go die for a word. If they don't like capitalism, choose something else, other vocabulary that's more congenial. What do you think of this word capitalism? Do you employ it yourself?
Not very often. I don't use it very often because it sounds like the system is designed for the benefit of capital, as opposed to labor, as if the goal is to allow capital to flourish at the expense of labor. That's certainly not the case. I much prefer to market economies, which means economies that allow people to make decisions freely through markets. Milton Friedman often referred to himself as a classical liberal or 19th century liberal, and I kind of like that view more. I think the belief in market economies is basically a belief that decentralized decision making, people left to their own devices, interacting in markets, with of course a rule of law. It's not anarchy, but you have a rule of law that's forcing contracts and preventing crime. I think that's the way to think of market economies, not as for the benefit of capital as opposed to labor. Mm.
Greg, the aforementioned Bill Buckley asked one question over and over again. He said he was weary asking it. How do you explain the popularity of socialism among people, despite the manifest failure of socialism's record? And I think his favorite answer came from Gene Kirkpatrick, who said, they have a much better vocabulary than we do. They have wonderful words like fairness, justice, solidarity, equality. You know, we're all in it together. And our words are scary. Personal responsibility, dynamism, risk. She said, no wonder they win. And I myself, but that really caused me to think. What say you to this? What would you have told Bill if he had asked you?
I think the appeal of socialism, especially by the young, has to do with the fact that it's very aspirational. It's like, you know, let's have a society where we're all in it together and we'll contribute our part and everybody will be treated well. And it sounds great until you realize the reality of it. And the reality is that any sort of socialist or communist system is going to give a lot of power to the government, necessarily. And the question then becomes, okay, do you really want to centralize power in the hands of a small number of people, even if they're democratically elected? I mean, if I would talk to a young socialist today, I'd say, look, knowing that once every generation or two, there'll be somebody like Donald Trump becoming president, do you want to give that person a lot more power? Or do you want to decentralize power in the hands of many people? So I think there's a reasonable fear of centralized power. I think the socialists make the mistake of thinking that the centralized power is all in the hands of Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos, whereas actually the real centralized power is in the hands of the federal government. And if we believe in decentralization, if you believe in sort of devolving power more to the individuals or communities, then I think market economies do much more of that than a socialist system that necessarily is going to centralize power in the state. I'm in the middle of reading actually a very interesting novel right now called Red Plenty, which is a novel that takes place during the Soviet Union during the era of central planning and during the 50s and 60s, and how it was like living in a centralized system, and what it was like for the central planners to try to, the difficulties they had to try to run an economy that was centralized. And even though their intentions are completely noble, you realize how fundamentally impossible their task was. The economies are way too complex to have any centralized authority run them. So to me, it's the case for markets is really a case for decentralization of power in the hands of individuals, families, communities.
Red Plenty, what a striking title. Is it a new novel, Greg, or an older one?
No, it's not very new. I think it's a few years old.
Uh-huh, new enough.
I had not heard of it until recently. A friend recommended it to me. And it's a dense book, so it's not a quick read, but what it's trying to do is trying to show you what it's like living in the minds of central planners during the era where they actually honestly believe that society could be better off by centralized planning and to see how difficult their task was. It was really fascinating.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are listening to Greg Mankiw, N. Gregory Mankiw, the famous economist, professor at Harvard. I'm Jay Nordlinger doing Q&A. Back after this word from our sponsor, The Spectator magazine. The Spectator is the longest-running magazine in the world, having been published in the UK for 191 years. The US edition launched last year and is bringing the same wit, wisdom, and insight to this country. The Spectator isn't your typical political magazine and doesn't inhabit left or right. It's known for its unique brand of journalism and coverage not only of politics, but also of arts, culture, food, wine, and travel. Sign up now, and they'll send you 3 free issues of the print magazine. Just go to spectator.us/ricochet. No obligations, and you can cancel at any time. Plus,
with the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
If you use offer code QA, they'll throw in a free Spectator Parker pen. Don't delay, because they're offering this to the first 1,000 people who sign up. I'll repeat this info in a bit. I know many people who write for The Spectator, and they are crack. They include Christopher Buckley, another Christopher Caldwell, P.J. O'Rourke, Douglas Murray, Toby Young, and Madeline Cairns. The magazine will inform, challenge, and entertain you. Again, sign up today and get 3 free issues of The Spectator by going to spectator.us/ricochet. And for that bonus Parker pen, use the offer code QA. Happy reading. Welcome back, everyone, to Q&A. I'm Jay Nordlinger, talking with the economist Greg Mankiw. Greg, some years ago, I can't remember whether it was on this program, I think it was for a print piece, I was talking with Senator Phil Graham, the ex-econ prof, and I said to him I was a little late to the appreciation of economic rights in my life, that I'd always been a strong believer in freedom of speech, right to assembly, freedom of worship, of course, and so on. But economic rights, you know, I was a little late to those. It seemed maybe a little bit selfish, a little grubby. And he said, oh, those are the ones on which all the others depend. And I didn't question him on it. I couldn't quite see the point, but I thought it might be true. Could you give us a word or two about economic rights and how they relate to other rights that we may think are sexier or more valuable, more fundamental?
Yeah, I think all of these rights are fundamentally based on the idea that people should be able to lead their lives as they choose. So, you know, whether I get to worship in the church or, you know, produce the kind of goods on my farm, those are all sort of very personal decisions that I think the founders of this country wanted people to be able to make on their own. Now, I wouldn't go to the extreme of saying that all personal decisions are beyond the control of government. So if my actions have effects on other people, what economists call externalities, and the government has a good justification for going in and saying, maybe we're going to regulate the exercise of your rights. So if my production on my farm causes pollution that adversely affects the farmer downstream, and the government might want to come in and sort of try to deal with that pollution problem. But as long as I'm not directly affecting anybody else, I'm just sort of leading my life as we see fit. I think there is a very strong parallel between what we think of as the non-economic rights, like freedom to worship, versus the economic rights, or freedom to sort of produce and consume as I see fit.
I think I mentioned talking with Hernando de Soto, and he has staked his claim. He has devoted much of his life to the defense and pursuit of property rights. I think for him, they're the linchpin. Are you of a similar mind? Give us a little bit about the importance of property rights.
Oh, yeah. No, I think de Soto's work is very interesting, because what he basically points out is that a lot of less developed countries, people's rights over what they think they own is often ambiguous and not easily enforced. And what that means is that it's very hard for people to rearrange assets, rearrange capital in a way that puts it to its best use. I think that is, I think he's exactly right about that. There's an old quote that goes back to Adam Smith. I'm not going to get it exactly right, but the quote is roughly that little is required to bring a nation from lowest barbarism to greatest opulence, but peace, easy taxes, the tolerable administration of justice. I think that's, if you look around the world at some of the world's poor countries, you realize that that's what they lack. I mean, so often it's countries where there's a revolution and coup, so they don't have the peace that allows markets to work and function, or they don't have a tolerable administration of justice, either because property rights aren't well defined, as de Soto has often pointed out, or because the what's supposed to be the justice system is in fact corrupt and actually a frequent infringer on property rights rather than an enforcer of property rights. So I think the idea that property rights and rule of law are central to economic prosperity is really an old idea that goes back to economics 250 years at least.
Greg, I mentioned one Latin American intellectual. I'm going to mention another one, Enrique Krause, the Mexican historian. Before this lockdown, I think it was just about my last trip, I went to Mexico City to see him, and we had a long talk. And before I left, I was speaking to another Latin American intellectual, a young man, and he said, ask him about income inequality and what to do it and what to do about it and how to confront this, because according to my young friend, friend of mine here in New York, the populace gain great ground when they speak of income inequality, and it's a subject ripe for demagoguery. Anyway, sorry I'm rambling along here, but I get to Krause, who is not like me. He's not a Hayekian. He's not a free marketeer. I think he calls himself, he's not a socialist or a commie. I think he calls him a social democrat in economics. And economics and other aspects of governmental life. And he said he was for UBI, universal basic income. And I didn't use the word leveler. He said that would take the sting out of a lot of this, and it would defang the populists. And I never quite liked the idea, because I say, why should tax dollars go to the rich in addition to others? But I've been talking long enough. Tell me how to think about UBI, universal basic income.
Yeah, I'm actually sympathetic to the idea of UBI. In fact, it goes back to an old idea that Milton Friedman wrote about in Capitalism and Freedom back in 1962, I believe, which he called a negative income tax. But a negative income tax is pretty much the same thing as a universal basic income. It's guaranteeing a minimum level of income for everyone, regardless of their circumstances. Now, the fact that it would go to the rich doesn't really bother me, because whatever financing system we have for the UBI, the rich would end up paying more in than they're going to get back. So they're not going to be net beneficiaries of this. So take the Andrew Yang version, which he proposed when he was running for president. He basically wanted to give everybody $1,000 a month, $12,000 a year, and it was to fund that by a value added tax. Well, yes, even the rich guys are going to get $1,000 a month, but they're going to pay so much more in that value added tax, so they're not going to be net beneficiaries of this. So the fact that it's going to the rich, I think is a red herring. I think the big question is, do you think that everyone should be guaranteed a certain level of income, regardless of circumstance? What we have now is a social safety net that tries to give money to the deserving poor. That the Social Security system gives money to people because they're old. Disability system gives money to people because they're disabled. The Earned Income Tax Credit gives money to the working poor whose wages are too low to bring them up to a certain standard of living. So we have all these different systems that says, oh, you're disadvantaged and you deserve money because of your particular circumstance. And what UBI does is it says, look, we're going to get the government out of the business of saying some people are more deserving than others. We're going to say everybody, just by virtue of being an American, is going to be guaranteed a minimum standard of living. Right, so the $12,000 a year that Andrew Yang proposed basically brings everybody up to the poverty line. And that strikes me as eminently reasonable, certainly doable in a rich country like this one. So I'm actually fairly sympathetic to it. But some Americans hate the idea not only of giving money to the rich, but giving money to the undeserving poor. So if some surfer dude who just says, I'm able-bodied, but I don't want to work, I just spend more time surfing, so just give me my $12,000 a year and I'll be happy spending my day surfing. Some Americans look at that surfer dude and say, we shouldn't be giving money to that guy.
But would you be okay with it, with his receiving his 12 grand and just catching the waves and smoking his dubs and whatnot?
My view is that they're probably not that many people like that. Not many people say, I'm happy living at the poverty line. I don't want to do any work. The way I raise myself out of poverty. So I don't think it's going to be a huge problem. And if there are a few people like that, fine. I mean, it doesn't strike me as the most repugnant thing that policy has ever done. So I'm okay with that. But I think that's the thing that makes it hard to sell, is that some people think, well, gosh, why should somebody who can work get money? And I think that's really where the sticking point is. So now we have a system now where we're trying to just figure out who's deserving, who's not. And our systems are really imperfect. So, for example, disability insurance gives people the money who are disabled. And most people probably think, yeah, if somebody's disabled, of course we should help them out. But there's a lot of disabilities that are very hard to diagnose. If you have very bad back pain, doctor really can't see it. So doctors don't really know. So we have a system of doctors trying to evaluate who really is disabled, who's not. It's a very anti-conservative idea because the government has to be very invasive to figure out who's really deserving, who's not deserving. And so the UBI says, we're going to get the government out of the business of deciding who's better than others, who's more deserving than others. Let's give everybody a minimum of $12,000 a year and call it a day.
Greg, income inequality, wealth inequality is such a touchy subject, and it's so individual, so psychological. I may be a little bit weird in this and other respects. I really don't mind it. If I'm doing okay and making progress, I don't care if my neighbor is also doing okay and making progress and has a lot more than I. The classic example is, I make 10 grand, my neighbor makes 20, double the income of both of us. Now the gap is twice as wide. I must say, I don't care at all. I'm so happy to be doubled. I'm not envious, but I know this is a very, very sensitive subject. And it really does seem to me we're in the realm of the psychological. Tell me what you think.
I think my perspectives are much closer to yours. I'll remind you that envy is one of the seven deadly sins. So I think I'm glad that's one we don't suffer from. But I feel the same way. I'm not worried about people at the top of the wealth distribution. I'm not worried about Bill Gates getting fabulously wealthy. I'm more worried about people at the bottom. Mm. I think some people look at wealth inequality, have a very zero-sum view of wealth, in the sense that, if Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates are getting fabulously wealthy, they must be at the expense of someone else. I don't think that's how economies work. I'd much rather have a prosperous economy where everybody can prosper rather than trying to figure out ways to get the rich to be less rich.
Indeed. Well, ladies and gentlemen, to remind you, I'm Jay Nordlinger doing Q&A with the economist Greg Mankiw. We'll be back for our final segment after this word from our sponsor, ExpressVPN. It is important to have a VPN. And if you're working from home, it's even more important to have a VPN you can trust. ExpressVPN is what you want. Here are a few big reasons. ExpressVPN doesn't log your data. Lots of really cheap or free VPNs make money by selling your data to ad companies. ExpressVPN developed a technology called Trusted Server, making it impossible to log any of your info. Then there's speed. Many VPNs slow down your connection or make your device sluggish. You don't have to worry about that with ExpressVPN. Even when you connect to servers thousands of miles away, you can still stream HD quality videos with zero lag. Something else that sets ExpressVPN apart is how easy it is to use. Unlike with other VPNs, you don't have to input or program anything. You just fire up the app and click one button to connect. It's so easy, even your grandparents could use it. No offense to your grandparents. Who's saying all this? Well, Wired, Verge, and many other tech journals, which rate ExpressVPN the number one VPN in the world. So, protect yourself with ExpressVPN. Go to expressvpn.com/QA today and get an extra 3 months free on a one-year package. That's expressvpn.com/QA. Visit expressvpn.com/QA to learn more. And we thank ExpressVPN for sponsoring Q&A. Welcome back, everyone, to Q&A. I'm Jay Nordlinger, speaking with the economist, the professor at Harvard, and Gregory Mankiw. We don't really like him, Greg, at all. But was Marx great? Did he have a big mind? Or was he a fraud, a nuisance? What to make of him?
Well, he's an unusual figure in the history of economics in the sense that he probably had more single influence in the world than any economist ever. And he still shows up tremendously on reading lists. Well, not reading lists in economics courses, mainly history courses. The Communist Manifesto is still on lots of reading lists because it was such an important document historically. In terms of his influence on economics, is almost minuscule. If you look at what we teach in the classroom today in economics, very little of it you can trace back to Karl Marx. You can trace it. There's a lot of important figures of that era. You know, going before Marx is Adam Smith. In the 19th century, there was David Ricardo. In the early 20th century, there's John Maynard Keynes, and then Paul Samuelson, Milton Friedman, later in the 20th century. So they're really big figures in the history of economic thought whose influence you can still see in what we teach today in textbooks. Karl Marx did not really contribute intellectually to the field of economics, even though he's obviously helped create this political movement that influenced
had baneful effects.
Hundreds of millions of people worldwide.
Greg, are there a handful of economists who are closest to your heart, would you say, or to whom you feel the most debt or the most kinship, let's say kindred spirits among, you know, I'm talking about centuries ago as well as present?
One of my favorite economists of all time is Milton Friedman. George Stigler once referred to him as the best economist in a bad century, meaning the 20th century wasn't quite as good as the 19th century, but within the 20th century, Milton Friedman was at the top. And I still assign his book, Capitalism and Freedom, when I teach a freshman seminar. I have a freshman seminar. It's really a reading group that I teach once a year at Harvard. And the first book I assign is The Worldly Philosophers, which is a history of economic thought. And the second book I assign is Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom. And the students, even those who disagree with it, appreciate the book for the clarity of its arguments. I mean, Friedman takes a strong stand. He's very libertarian. He calls himself classical liberal, but today he would probably call it libertarian. And he makes a very clear case of why he's making these arguments. And students appreciate the clarity of the prose. I had one student who was from Santa Monica, and he was basically a socialist. And he said he really appreciated the book. He said, these are the arguments I have to figure out how to argue against. And I thought that was very clever, because he understood that, you know, there's other points of view, and he's got to figure out how to respond to them intelligently. And so he appreciated how clear the arguments were in Friedman's book.
I assume you knew Friedman.
We met a few times. In fact, when I was a relatively young assistant professor, I happened to be going up to, he already retired from Chicago and had retired at the Stanford campus, the Hoover Institute. And I sent him a letter and said, you know, Professor Friedman, we've never met, but I've been an admirer of yours for a long time. Can I stop by your office just to see you? When I'm over on the Stanford campus for this conference. And he wrote me back saying, well, I'm not going to be on campus that day, but if you'd like to come up to my house, he had a house outside north of the city, actually by the coast. He said, if you'll come up to my house, we can have lunch. And so he invited me up to lunch. So I had lunch with he and his wife.
The Rose. House,
three of us. Yeah. Rose. And they're charming people, really lovely. That was the first time I met him. I met him a few times after that. But I didn't know him well. I mainly knew him through his work.
Sure.
And reading him in a variety of different forms. And it makes you appreciate how influential you can be even to people you never meet.
Greg, I'm going to ask you a question in a funny way. I know you won't mind it. In a time of pandemic, are all bets off? Are all our principles out the window? Is it spend, is it spend, hold your nose, get back to normal later? What do you think?
Well, we're certainly in very unusual times. I mean, not only is this a very deep recession, this is unusual even for recessions, in the sense that usually when we're in a recession, it's kind of an accident, and we want to get people back to work as quickly as possible. Here, in some sense, the recession was intentional. Given the pandemic, we didn't want people to go to work. We wanted people to stop spending. We wanted people to stay at home. So it's, in some sense, the first recession by design that I've ever seen. We sort of put policies in place that would sort of guarantee a recession. We are spending a lot, not so much to put people back to work in this case, but basically to help people over a very difficult time. It's really sort of disaster relief more than it is stimulus. And I think it's the appropriate thing to do. I have quibbles about the details. I won't go into that. But I think the basic idea of spending lots of money to help people over this very difficult time, I think, makes sense. That doesn't mean all the rules are off forever. We'll have to worry about the increased government debt at some point, presumably with lower spending or higher taxes. But I think spending a lot and running big debt deficits during this particular time seems to be the right thing to do.
Greg, I'm going to ask you some more questions here in our final minutes, and I'm really being unfair because these are questions about which many, many books have been written, and we're just doing a casual conversation here. But thank you for bearing with me. I may be the last flat taxer on Earth. We're like the Flat Earth Society, us flat taxers. Do you have any use for the idea? Do you?
Well, I remember as a student reading. I remember reading the Hall Robuchka book on the flat tax many, many years ago. I think I was a grad student at the time when that book came out, and reading it and thinking it's a very compelling tax system. As a practical policy maker, though, the idea of saying we're going to scrap the entire tax code and replace it with something new seems very unlikely. It seems sort of too large a leap for our system that tends to be more incremental. So the way I view the Hall Robuchka book is it's sort of a describing a system that towards which we can aspire. And as we think about tax reform, incremental tax reforms, we can ask ourselves, are we getting closer or farther away from an ideal? And I still think it's a very important book and important idea. I would be shocked to ever find it implemented wholesale under our current political system.
Greg, I've told this story. I'm sure listeners are sick of it. I hope it might interest you. It has to do with two people I've talked with, mentioned already, Bill Buckley and Phil Graham. Graham once told Buckley that he never mentioned trade on the stump. And Buckley said, why? You're so well-equipped to explain trade and to argue for it and defend it. And he'd done this in the classroom for many years. And Graham said something like, well, trade benefits almost everyone and they don't know it. And trade harms some, and they all know it. Therefore, there's no percentage for a politician in bringing it up. My worry is that trade goes undefended. Who will step up and defend trade, especially in a time of nationalism, populism, socialism? I feel that the trade is very lonely, yet it benefits so many. What say you?
Oh, I agree with you completely. Economics professors defend trade all the time, and that's true people on both the center left and center right. So it's not you get people, the populist left and the populist right, that I think are often anti-trade. But most mainstream economists, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, tend to be pretty pro-free trade. I think of NAFTA, which was negotiated by the elder George Bush and then passed under Bill Clinton. But that was sort of really much of a bipartisan effort, which I think most economists think was the right thing to do. It's hard to defend, because precisely for the reason that Phil Graham tells in that story. I think there's also a natural xenophobia that's built into humans. That is, think of the time where we evolved, on the savannah somewhere. If you saw a group of people coming over the horizon that you didn't recognize, they were probably coming to kill you, steal your food, and rape your women. They probably weren't coming over to engage in mutually advantageous gains from trade, yes, a la Adam Smith and David Ricardo.
Yes.
So I think it's a natural xenophobia, and we say, gosh, if one country is doing well and we're trading with them, that must be coming at our expense. And one of the first things I teach when I teach introductory economics is that's not right. I mean, the David Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage is that trade is win-win. Both sides benefit. And that, I think, is such an important lesson. And that's true, of course, not only trade among nations, it's trade among people, right? When you go to your barber, he's not taking advantage of you. He's providing a service, and you're grateful to pay him for that service. And we should feel the same way when we're trading with other nations.
Mm. The topic of economics and immigration is a big, big one. You could write 10 volumes on it. I'll just give you a little story, something sort of vignette-y. We were having a bit of an argument at National Review the other day, and should au pairs be kept out in these times? You know, girls, young women from abroad, you know, coming and seeing some of America, getting a taste of a foreign country, looking after other people's children, working on their English, you know, flirting with local boys. The family gets a benefit out of it. You know, the kids have a taste of the great way. You know, I just think it's a beautiful setup. And a great many people say, no, 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 that takes babysitting work away from natives. That is unfair, especially in horrible economic times. And I guess like a lawyer, like a stereotype of a lawyer, I mean, I could put on one hat and argue one way and another hat and argue the other. Talk to me about this, if you would.
Yeah, my favorite line about immigration comes from Pat Paulson, who you may remember,
yeah, sure,
used to run for president every 4 years back in, I guess, the 60s and 70s.
Comedian, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And one of his lines was, he said, every problem that the United States faces can be traced to an unenlightened immigration policy on the part of the American Indian. And I think the point was that almost all of us here were immigrants, and the economy and the nation is extremely prosperous because of the immigration, not despite the immigration. And I still think that's true. I think immigration is incredibly beneficial for both nations, but most especially actually for the immigrants. If you really care about poor people, the poorest people on the planet are people who don't have the opportunity to work in the United States. And so when these poor immigrants come in, their lives are so tremendously better and improved than their children's lives. I mean, as we mentioned earlier, that all four of my grandparents were in Ukraine. Imagine they hadn't immigrated here and I'd been born in Ukraine instead. I am sure I would be less prosperous than I am now. I'd be less free than I am now. My life would be far worse. Mm-hmm. I think we should sort of remember that. I'll actually give your readers a book recommendation. I just finished it. It's a book called Open Borders by Brian Kaplan. Brian Kaplan's an economics professor at George Mason University, and he wrote this book, Open Borders, to argue in favor of freer immigration. It's not a traditional book. It's a graphic novel. This is a brilliant thing. It's an economist writing in the form of a graphic novel. It's a very quick read. You can read it in a day. And it really does go through some serious economic and philosophical arguments about the arguments regarding immigration.
Greg, you may remember this. Reagan used to joke, I don't worry about the deficit. It's big enough to take care of itself. But that was a joke.
Yeah.
And we've got this mammoth budget deficit and this mammoth national debt. And, you know, people like me say there will be a reckoning. And yet the decades pass There's not a reckoning. I think Michael Kinsley, to his credit, used to kid himself because all through the Reagan years, he hated Reagan. So he predicted a long, hot summer because of bad race relations. Now we have it, of course, or at least some of it. That he actually joked that, you know, I know I keep predicting a long, hot summer every summer. So when people like me keep saying there will be a reckoning, maybe others look at people like me and say, ah, you guys have been saying that for years.
Well, there is an interesting phenomenon that we don't fully understand as economists, which is that interest rates, real interest rates adjusted for inflation, have been trending down for 40 years. Basically, since roughly 1980, since roughly the time of Reagan, interest rates have been falling. What that means is servicing a debt is easier for any given size. And that means that pushes off the day of reckoning. That doesn't mean that we could run the debt off to infinity. But it does put off the day of reckoning because even though the debt has gone up, the debt service hasn't gone up nearly as much because interest rates have gone down. We economists don't really understand why there's this long-term trend in interest rates. And there's a lot of hypotheses out there, but it's at this point just a bit of a puzzle. Having said that, there will be a day of reckoning at some point if the debt keeps going up. That's going up not only because we're running big deficits now because of the recession, but as the baby boom generation retires and starts collecting Social Security and Medicare, spending is going to automatically rise and will keep rising. I'm sort of in the middle of the baby boom, and I presumably am just a few years away from starting to collect those. And that's going to put more upper pressure on spending. And at that point, we've got to figure out what to do, and it's probably going to be some combination of higher taxes and lower spending, and what kind of spending will be the big question, and yes. what taxes are going to go up. I mean, that's in some sense the big fiscal question for the next generation. The way I put it to my Harvard students is I say, my generation has promised us a certain level of Social Security and Medicare, and we've promised that you're going to pay for it. How do you feel about that?
What do they say?
They look at me blankly, like, okay, really? Because you know, I showed them the numbers, and it's inevitable that you know when I'm fully retired, my generation will be collecting a lot in Social Security and Medicare, and maybe it'd be easy to cut our benefits, but probably not. The elderly vote, and so cutting Social Security and Medicare is not going to be easy. Baby boomers retired.
Greg, just a minute of politics, if you don't mind. You were a Republican for many, many years. I think as a child you were a Republican, and or at least as a very young person. And you worked for President Bush, 43. You worked for or with Mitt Romney. And then you left the party in this era, Me Too. Do you ever see going back, or do you think you're sort of independent for life?
Well, it all depends on what the party does. There are still voices in the party that I have great respect for, including Mitt Romney, who I think has done a great job being very independent as a senator. There are other senators there in the Republican Party who I respect, who have been basically keeping their head down, hoping that this era of Trump passes and it goes back to sort of more normalcy. But if this Republicanism of the Donald Trump era continues, then I'll stay an independent. You know, this coming election, I fully expect to vote for Joe Biden, even though I'm sure his policies are far to the left of what I'd advocate.
Mm. Is this on the basis of does character enter into it?
Oh, it's largely character. Mm. It's not. I mean, some of the things Donald Trump's done, I agree with. Like I actually think kind of the tax rate. Mm-hmm. From the very high 35% to something that's more in line with historical norms was a good thing. So it's not. So it's not like every policy he's done I disagree with. It's just that I think the character issues are great, and I think actually the foreign policy issues loom large in my mind. The situation in Ukraine, situation with the Kurds, the giving a cold shoulder to NATO, picking fights over trade with Mexico and Canada. I mean, there's all sorts of ways in which he's alienated people who should be our allies.
You really are a Reaganite. You're speaking the old religion for
exactly,
sure.
Exactly. Yes.
Me
exactly.
too. Finally, here, Greg. This may be a little bit tricky. May even require you to speak against interest. But this blockbuster textbook of yours, Principles of Economics, it sold over 2 million copies and it's in 20 languages. Maybe you can't judge this, but can a person on his own at home, not a student, just an earnest person wanting to learn? Can he read this book and benefit from it, or is it the kind of book that really needs the guidance of a teacher in the classroom?
No, I've had many people say they were just interested and just picked up a copy on their own just to read it. Sometimes there's students, like a high school student who doesn't have an economics course at his high school, who'll just pick it up and read it on his own, or just somebody who's sort of more middle-aged like me who says, I'm just kind of interested in economics. So it's not designed to be written to be a beach read. It's designed to be used in a classroom, but it's also designed to be self-contained. It doesn't need the teacher there. So if I've done a good job, it should be readable, even by someone without a teacher standing by.
If you hadn't done this, what do you think you would have done in life? Law, math, high school teacher?
Well, I decided math was too abstract for me. I did go to law school for a year and a half, and I might have become a lawyer. I spent a summer working in a law firm, decided it was too much like a real job. Being a professor is great because you have a tremendous intellectual freedom to think about things you want to think about. I love life in universities. But I could easily imagine being a lawyer. I could also imagine becoming a full-time policy economist. The economists who work, say, at the Congressional Budget Office do great work doing very impartial analysis of policy proposals that come across their desk. So I could easily imagine life doing that kind of work.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am Jay Nordlinger doing Q&A. Our producer is Scott Immergut. Our sponsors are The Spectator Magazine and ExpressVPN. And we've been talking with Greg Mankiw, professor of economics at Harvard. Not a cent of tuition paid today. Thank you. Thank you so much. That was so enjoyable and enriching. Appreciate it, Professor.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Jay.
Till next time, everyone.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.